This is an appendix to episode 41 of Pomegranate Health on diabetes therapy. That episode examines the question of where to set specific targets for glycemic control and what benefits new drug classes can bring. You'll hear from RACP fellows Dr. Paul Drury from Auckland DHB and Professor Sophia Zungas from Monash Health. Please go to the website racp.edu.au/podcast for the full episode and other references linked.
Clearly, I think all the trials now agree that in microvascular disease, you do see a benefit. I won't say relatively quickly, but it's of the course of maybe 2, 5 and up to 10 years, whereas I don't think there's any evidence that improving glycemic control improves macrovascular outcomes until at least 10 years on. And in fact, the improvements that have been seen in outcomes in the newer agent trials recently have been related not so much to glycemic control as to other actions of the specific drugs. And
controversy, the challenge in explaining those classic trials was that the UK PDS seemed to show very strong effects on microvascular and macrovascular complications, but the patients were quite young. The average age was 54 and they tended to be newly diagnosed, as compared to the other three less dramatic studies where the ages were 60 to 66 and patients had been ill for at least 8 years in those studies.
Yes, in fact, UK PDS, you had to be newly diagnosed. And by definition, therefore, you're going to have younger patients than in the other studies who where you had to be an established person with diabetes for some years and have got some damage from it. And whichever microvascular complication you look at, then largely you can't reverse the damage that's already been done. What you can do is prevent or slow the subsequent development of more damage, or any damage if you catch people early enough. And there is the...
I mean, the fact that all of the international guidelines do at least put, you know, microvascular benefits up there, if not macrovascular ones, does it suggest that there's some attachment to the theory, the logic that this should benefit, even if the numbers don't come out as strongly as we'd like?
I'm old enough to remember when everybody believed that good glycemic control was good for you, but nobody had actually shown it. And then we had, over the course of about 5 years, the DCCT results, and then UK PDS. And they are completely chalk and cheese in terms of being type 1 versus type 2 and many other ways. But I think they did confirm many much smaller studies that were really well done and showed things like some of the pump studies and retinopathy that did very clearly show benefit. So I think we still have to go with on the basis that physiologically, pathophysiologically, if you look at histology, you know, it all adds up that way. And we now have a much better understanding of the biochemical and structural changes behind it. This way, I think you'd struggle to make a case that there is no relationship.
And the sort of parting caveat in that NZSSD report is the possibility of ethnic differences in glycation rates. Do you want to mention perhaps the data on African Americans and possibilities in the New Zealand population that there might be differences?
Yes. I mean, there are ethnic differences in other populations. To my knowledge, no detailed study has been done. And the problem with all these, in order to show these sort of differences, you have to have really massive numbers and you have to have the same assay in the same place, all of which is difficult to do. And expensive to do. So as far as I know, we're not a lot further along that line.
And as you say, the individualization has become the rule, and the Australian guidelines emphasize this strongly. One particular question I had for you, the single out women planning a pregnancy for more intensive targets still. It says to aim for the tightest achievable control without severe hypoglycemia before and during pregnancy, preferably under 43 millimole per mole or 6%. How feasible is that, and how much does the risk of gestational diabetes amplify otherwise?
It's probably not my area of most speciality, but it's fair to say that if you're talking about people with type 2 diabetes or at risk of gestational diabetes, then the tighter the better, because the HbA1c normal range shifts down in pregnancy. Therefore, it's not just making it tighter, it's according with the change.
Uh-huh.
With type 1 diabetes, then good control is important, but I think you would struggle with many patients with type 1 to get their HbA1c down to the low 40s, as it were, without unacceptable hypoglycemia.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's really, really important is that we identify in early pregnancy those who have type 2 diabetes, which used to be a really rare event, and now is not, because they have outcomes just as bad as people with established type 1. And certainly the New Zealand position on this is that there is now an HbA1c test done with the booking bloods that identifies those who have undiagnosed diabetes, but also actually identifies those who've got, as it were, pre-diabetes at that stage. And there is an algorithm then that says how they should be managed.
This whole story started with the idea for this podcast started with the furor that was kicked up by the American College of Physicians' new standards in April for new targets for glycemic control, and I guess it seems like a storm in a teacup, but sort of language is important. And for example, the New Zealand Society for Study of Diabetes document says a range of 55 to 64 or 8% is higher than ideal, but may be appropriate and acceptable in many individuals. This language isn't so different from the ACP, the American College of Physicians guidelines, which stated that clinicians should aim to achieve an HbA1c level between 7 and 8% in most patients with type 2 diabetes. So, and this was criticized as being too permissive, but do you think it just reflects a shift away from focusing on those numbers and worrying instead about the big picture?
I think where I took umbrage with the ACP rate was the hint that this was right for most people.
Mm.
Whereas I think the New Zealand, now very outdated recommendations, were not for most people. They were for some people.
Okay.
I think we would echo the American and European recommendations that personalization is what's really important. And if you go back to the 2012 and 2015 recommendations, there was a very elegant little graph on what should make you, for an individual, go towards the more stringent and less stringent. And so if you had...
Which we'll get into right now, I think. So, I mean, even those original trials used a smorgasbord of glucose-lowering drugs that listeners will be familiar with. But when the American College of Physicians released its guidelines, they openly stated that they didn't consider evidence around the new drug classes like SGL2 inhibitors, DPP4 inhibitors, GLP receptor agonists. As Kasia Lipska, endocrinologist Kasia Lipska, put in a 2017 editorial for JAMA, the effects of these new treatments are out of proportion to the small differences in glycemic control. The results of these studies imply that the type of drug used to achieve glycemic control matters because the total effect is not entirely conveyed by its effect on glucose levels. Was that to be expected, or is it a surprise that you can influence those other risks so dramatically?
I think for GLP-1 analogues in particular, it wasn't really a surprise. It was hoped for because they have a lot of other apparently beneficial pharmacological effects than just reducing glucose. So they're actually very good at reducing glucose. So I think from that point of view, that's what everybody had been hoping for. And it's just taken quite a number of years to get big enough trials of eligible people in order to show benefit. SGLT2 is perhaps a little bit more of a surprise. They clearly have a number of pharmacological actions, including sort of weight loss and effect on blood pressure that are also likely to be beneficial. Mm-hmm. But I think the extent of the benefit was perhaps at the top end of expectations. If you go to DPP-4, then really there's not an enormous amount of evidence of benefit there. And their biggest advantage really is that they don't produce hypoglycemia and as such are a good choice for patients in whom hypoglycemia is a particular no-no for occupational or other reasons. But they're fairly weak in their glycemic effects compared certainly with GLP-1 and with metformin.
Still playing catch-up. And indeed, the studies, as per usual, they're not cut and dry. The effects are small, and the various studies, are a bit muddy, and some interpretation is required. Do you have any sense of, here we go again? That we're just as with those original glycemic control studies, we're jumping onto these recommendations that in 10 years' time might not prove to be so accurate once all the evidence comes in?
I think I'm reasonably happy that we've waited for enough studies before jumping too soon. Mm-hmm. I think the impressive thing about the recent report is that they have done a very neat, concise summary of the degree of benefit from the new agents. And it rings the bell of truth. It states it concisely, and then they have made recommendations that enact it. What is always reassuring is that the physiology of GLP-1 agonists and of SGLT2 inhibitors leads one to hope that they would have those effects. Yep. And the trials have now delivered saying, yes, they do in selected patient groups who were in the study. And those are quite small patient subgroups.
In light of that new ADA and EASD statement, which is very thorough and comprehensive and takes into account the new drugs, for the ACP to come out in April, it seems almost anachronistic to focus so much attention on the glycemic targets when there's so much else coming.
I think, to be fair to them, yes, this no doubt came out in April, but was probably written 6-9 months before that, and there were fewer of the new drugs available. But the fact that they ignored them completely or virtually completely I think tells you the quality of the work that went behind it. And I think that should now be put in the dustbin of history, really.
Back to the SGL2 inhibitors. Of those studies of SGL2 inhibitors, the authors say the evidence of benefit is modestly stronger for empagliflozin than canagliflozin. It's been shown to reduce risk of mortality in major cardiovascular events and some markers of kidney pathology. When talking about an effect of GLP-1 inhibitors on cardiovascular risk, there's evidence that liraglutide reduces the risk of major cardiovascular events and mortality, while semaglutide reduces risk but not mortality. And other GLP-1 inhibitors have not been so convincing.
So liraglutide and semaglutide have clearly made it, and empagliflozin is leading on canagliflozin, not to say that it's going to win the race in 10 years' time. But the big caveat I would say is that the benefit that's been shown for GLP-1 and for SGLT2 are applicable to those patients who either have established cardiovascular disease or who have chronic kidney disease. And I think we need to be careful not to assume that that benefit applies substantially to people without those complications. And of course, the companies may well want to take that and extrapolate it to groups of patients who have not been studied and for whom you would expect the benefit to be substantially less. I'd actually look around the world and say that the uptake of DPP-4 as well as GLP-1 and SGLT-2 has been greater than justified by the evidence. If you go to DPP-4, then really there's not an enormous amount of evidence of benefit there. And their biggest advantage really is that they don't produce hypoglycemia and as such are a good choice for patients in whom hypoglycemia is a particular no-no for occupational or other reasons. But they're fairly weak in their glycemic effects compared certainly with GLP-1 and with metformin.
So, if you look at the most robust and meta-analysis of these trials of more versus less glucose control, that included the four main trials. Indeed, that did show a 9% reduction in major cardiovascular events, a composite that included cardiovascular death. Indeed, that particular publication in Diabetology actually was conducted by the trialists themselves. They redid their analyses and pulled their tabular data, and they had much more ability to do new subgroup analyses that were directly relevant to clinical practice.
Kasia Lipska, in her JAMA article, briefly skims over the research around these new drugs, and it's currently no less baffling than the papers we discussed earlier. The SGL2 inhibitor empagliflozin reduced the risk of major cardiovascular events and mortality and reduced markers of kidney pathology without a direct effect on glycemic control. The GLP-1 agonist liraglutide had a similar effect on cardiovascular outcomes, while semaglutide reduced risk but not mortality, and semaglutide improved nephropathy endpoints at the same time as it increased the risk of retinopathy. But her take-home message, and I quote, is, "The effects of treatment on outcomes were out of proportion to the small differences in glycemic control levels. The results of these studies imply that the type of drug used to achieve glycemic control matters, because the total effect is not entirely conveyed by its effect on glucose levels." What do you think this conversation is going to look like in a few years' time?
So that's the whole discussion around what effects are glucose dependent or glucose independent. And what we're seeing with these new classes of drug is that there are potential glucose independent effects, you know, that are translating into benefits. The question is, will those effects be observed over time, and in which particular patient groups? So, yes, so with the SGLT2 inhibitors and the GLP-1s, where there's an increasing body of evidence that they not only reduce cardiovascular events, but in fact, in the case of the SGLT2 inhibitors, reduce total mortality, particularly from heart failure hospitalisation, then one would suggest that the target is not part of the decision-making process, rather the assessment of cardiovascular risk. Ultimately, I think we need active comparator studies where you compare one drug to another and understand then where its place will be. And also, you know, the age of precision medicine, where we'll be able to somehow genotype a particular individual and understand what the best drug for them is. In the meantime, all we can do is...
So if you just look at the ACCORD trial, the, as we mentioned, was stopped early because of the increased mortality in the intensive treatment group. It's been suggested that this might have been the glitter zones or the rapid rate at which A1C was brought down. Has there been any clearer understanding of what would explain those findings?
So my understanding is that the ACCORD investigators have spent many hours reanalyzing their data. They have excluded the glitter zones as being the cause, and I think there was only a small proportion of use of glitter zones throughout the trial. Indeed, they have concluded that it may actually be a chance finding, and that if they had continued the intervention, the randomised intervention for longer, that that signal would have disappeared. My personal view is that, you know, these were people that a significant proportion already were on insulin, and then they added further therapy or traded the insulin very aggressively within a sort of window of 3 to 6 months. Generally, in clinical practice, that isn't what we do. We're much more concerned. Conservative and modest.
And you and William Kefalu write that keeping A1C below 6.5% is a goal that can be attained with little risk of hypoglycemia or weight gain by many patients, even without the use of recently developed glucose-lowering agents. So what are the best agents to use in this context?
So what we're referring to there particularly is the use of lifestyle and metformin, where you may have an individual on metformin is easily able to achieve a glycemic target of less than 6.5% without any risk of hypoglycemia. Or the DPP-4 inhibitors, the gliptins, and in combination with metformin would be a very safe dual therapy combination and may lead to achievement of an A1C less than 6.5%. And we've got a raft of other drugs now that of themselves don't increase risk of hypoglycemia.